Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of The Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the wonderful island chained paradise nation, surrounded by Fukushima radiation, so that when you go sunbathing, you still soak up the rays. And my very special guest today's is Stephen Berry from Auckland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Vinnie.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do, mate?
Well, I've been involved in politics for probably about 15 years now. When most people were having fun and playing pranks and going to parties at high school, I was studying politics, which you can imagine did wonders for my social life. I got started in the ACT Party when I was 16. I was with them for a couple of years. Then when I turned 19, I decided to run for Parliament as an independent in Mount Roskill, which is obviously spectacularly unsuccessful, but I wasn't put off at all. Following that, I discovered libertarianism and joined the Libertarians Party, which probably destroyed my political career for quite some time.
As it does.
But I did stand for Mayor of Auckland in 2004, did reasonably well in there.
Out of how many candidates, where did you come?
I think I came fifth, just after the Christians Against Abortion guy, but I did manage to crack the 1,000 vote mark, so I was pretty happy with that.
Excellent.
Yep. After that, I kind of lost interest in politics for a little while, did my own thing, focused on my work. I work in supermarkets, been doing that for 15 years, and then probably about 3-4 years ago, with the advent of Ron Paul in the United States and saying, hey, maybe this libertarianism thing can go somewhere, I got interested again and stood again as an independent in Tamaki. Once again, spectacularly unsuccessful, to be honest. I was going to join the ACT Party again, but when John Banks was their sole MP, I just couldn't bring myself to do it. So I got involved in the Libertarians Party again and worked on a rebranding effort to try and bring other parties together, such as the ALCP, a new grouping at the time called True Liberals. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. Libertarians is no more. But as part of that rebrand effort, we came up with the concept of Affordable City, which is a nationwide local body political party. We had parties standing in 7 boroughs around New Zealand. Got 45,000 votes around the country collectively, which goes to show that the model was quite sound. And in Affordable Auckland, we ran 3 council candidates, as well as myself for mayor, and someone in a local board as well. Didn't get anyone elected, but we did get some very good results. Nico Cloten in Franklin picked up 23% of the vote for council. I got third for the mayoralty myself, which was a bit of a surprise, but a very pleasing one. And now with the election over and Len Brown's scandals, we're focused completely on getting his resignation, and that will culminate in our protest on the 22nd of February at Brito Mart, 12 noon, for Len Brown to stand down.
Yeah, and when it comes to the election of a mayor, one thing occurs to me, particularly with the advent of the super city, is that it puts it outside the price range of most people who would be running for what I would say genuine reasons and what have you, and more or less allows for massive corporate interests, like, for example, the Committee for Auckland, to come in and back the candidates that will support their agenda rather than a candidate that will come in and support the people in reducing rates and increasing the amount of freedoms that we actually have in our city, because it occurs to me that they seem to be shrinking more and more as days go by. One thing in particular that struck me as quite frightening was around about the Rugby World Cup. We did a protest and we had one of these little council people in a yellow jacket telling us that we can't hand out flyers at a protest. There was even a huge protest in the middle of the street and what have you, with hundreds of people, and still these council people were telling us that we can't hand out our own flyers to other people at our own protest that we've got a council permit for. The sky's the limit when it comes to restricting people's freedom, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And as time goes on, we just see more laws, more regulations, more bureaucrats controlling what we can do with our lives. And I'm certainly trying to roll that back through the Affordable Auckland model.
Well, can you explain the intricate details of the Affordable Auckland model so the listeners can get a decent idea of it?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously I've spent, you know, the last decade trying to advance extreme libertarianism. And that's gone down like a cup of cold vomit. People aren't buying it, and hey, fair enough. So if you want to achieve any sort of change in politics, you need to be able to take the people with you, and you need to offer them something that they can actually buy into, and they're not going to do that with libertarianism, so you know, let's stop doing that. So Affordable Auckland's about trying to pick your battles you can win, and pick goals which you can take the voters along with you. We chose a 5-point program of cutting rates, cutting spending, eliminating borrowing, protecting private property rights, and getting rid of the urban boundary, etc., so people can do what they want with their own properties, and affordable housing, which the first four lead up to the five, really. And we've found we got a lot of good feedback from that and quite a bit of support. So we've shown that picking our battles and picking things that we can take the public along with us is actually a lot more beneficial.
Can we go through the technical aspects of how you would actually achieve each step of that plan? So the first thing was what, cutting rates?
Yep, and that's quite a lofty idea, especially when you consider the percentage of revenue the council gets from borrowing is actually the same percentage of revenue that the council gets from rates. So that's actually quite disturbing, and you're wondering, well, where can you cut? The council needs to come back to its core function, so it needs to focus on getting rid of the stormwater, picking up the rubbish, maintaining the footpaths, libraries, things like that. I don't think it should be funding festivals, etc. We've got, for example, $3,000 spent on skateboard ambassadors during a previous school holiday. Skateboarders to go around and tell other skateboarders how to behave. What a waste of money. We've got the tram system around Wynyard Quarter. $16 million has been sunk into that now. They're not even running at the moment. It's costing $70,000 a year to rent those trams off an Australian company. I mean, that's not core functions of council. Let's focus on the essentials and the must-haves, and then when we've got our books in order, when we're not charging exorbitant rates, maybe then we can look at the nice-to-haves.
Now, Penelope Bright has gone to, I think, a Transparency International conference one time, and they have, I think, published publicly that the root cause of corruption is privatisation. And how are almost all council services currently done, but with public-private partnerships and contracting out and what have you? So I see a big discrepancy there between running an efficient city with low rates and employing all of these people contracted out. Then there's accountants and so on and so forth, this whole mix of things, plus there's the corruption possibility. Now, apparently apparently, back in the day before these first rounds of amalgamations, people were not only paying very low rates, but on occasions were even getting rate rebates under the borough council model. Allegedly, one person per street would be responsible for that street in terms of knowing the neighbours and the people on the street, any problems, trees and what have you. They'd call the council worker, guy in a council truck comes out, clean it up. And as a result, they had a very, very well tight-knit community, as well as a local government with a real voice for them. Whereas what's happening now with the super city, it's almost like, if I didn't know anybody, I'd say it's a deliberate attempt to ensure that people don't have any voice.
Well, one of the root causes of corruption, of course, are public-private partnerships, because it then gives the capacity for councillors and the people working for the council to be bought off. I wouldn't say that that's a problem with privatisation, however. Privatisation itself, I think, is a positive thing, because private companies, motivated by the profit motive, have a real, genuine reason to satisfy customers, whereas people working for a public service, every time, oh, we want a tree cut down or our drains are blocked, it's just more work to them. There's no incentive if they sort out these problems really efficiently. They still just take home their meagre salary each week. So I think the profit motive and further privatisation is actually would be a positive thing for the city. Unfortunately, we're hamstrung by current local government laws which actually mandate councils must do these things, so the change really can't happen at the local level.
Well, how exactly do they mandate that the council must do these things?
It's all under the Local Government Act, so there's sections in the Local Government Act which specifically say the council must do parks, it must do libraries, it must do stormwater.
Okay.
So, if they're going to do it with the private sector, it can only be done through contracting out.
Okay. And do you believe anything should be done in-house, or the entire city should be privatised, every single service?
I don't think every single service should be privatised. Obviously, things like parks, it's very difficult to make a profit out of those. So I'm not advocating whole-scale, widespread, 100% privatisation of the city. I think that's a bit silly, but things, for example, Second Harbour Crossing, why don't we get a private company to do it? The good thing about that is that, number one, the ratepayer pays nothing. They only pay if they use it. And number two, there is no financial risk for the council whatsoever. The company doing the work carries the risk itself. So if costs overrun or it doesn't quite work out, the ratepayer has no penalty at all. It's all on that private owner.
Well, I think what you've touched on here is something that's very important to notice between the difference between privatisation and public-private partnerships. Public-private partnerships are privatisation, in my opinion, much like partial pregnancy. You know, there's no such Petty would say. But what happens is if you've got a private company, that private company takes private personal responsibility, individual responsibility, in a word. Whereas if it's a partnership, that means it doesn't matter what the company does, it virtually never bears any liability, and it winds up just getting bailed out by everybody else's rates, who don't really get to vote on the issue, just their representatives.
Absolutely. That's why I'm not a big fan of public-private partnerships. They're probably a step better than complete public works, because that puts all the burden on the ratepayer. But ultimately, I think we should be getting private companies to do as much of these things as possible.
As long as we can weed out the corruption and increase the responsibility of those corporations as they're doing it at the same time, because obviously they're going to be doing something really for the public benefit in a lot of ways, despite the fact that there's a profit margin. Now, I don't know about you, but I make a living off of serving the public, and I actually do receive money for that. So I've got no problems with people doing the right thing and getting paid for it. What I really am concerned about is when people are doing a terrible job and get bailed out for it and don't have to bear any responsibility for the crap job that they're doing.
That's right, and that's not capitalism. I've worked in the supermarket industry for 15 years. I do my job so that I get paid. You know, that's my profit motive. But it also means that people get their meat, they get their canned veggies, whatever it is they want. I'm not doing it because I want those people to get canned veggies. I just want to make my money, but that's how I do it, by serving the public.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we've touched on that reduction in the rates issues. What's the next stage of the plan?
Spending.
How exactly are you going to rein in spending?
again, it comes down to core council functions that can only be done by the council. So let's focus on the stormwater, let's focus on the roads, the parks, the libraries, and let's stop trying to have all these nice-to-haves. I mean, we've got neighbourhood barbecues being held by some local boards to promote neighbourly get-togethers. I mean, people can do this if they want to. If they want to get to know their neighbours, let them do it.
Yeah.
But council and local boards certainly shouldn't be funding those sorts of things. So we really need to be tight on the purse strings. We need to say, is this a function that only the council can do? If it is, great, that's council business. But if it's something that people can do through voluntary cooperation or the private sector trying to make a profit, something like that, then so be it. I understand that, I'm not sure if the council funds the gay pride parade. I saw something in the Herald today saying that they were backing it. As much as I love the gay pride parade, I don't think it's something that should be funded by the council. Lantern Festival, I'm going along next week, and I'm sure it'll be lots of fun, but I don't think it should be funded by the council. Private voluntary organisations are more than capable of doing this, and we need to get away from the idea that, oh, if the government doesn't do it, it won't happen. The government, Jamie White pointed out very well that the government doesn't produce shoes, but it still happens, so.
Well, there's another element that we touched on there that's quite important, is that if a government is overly protective and overly providing for a community, they don't actually help the community. They wind up hamstringing and destroying it, and indeed almost eliminate voluntarism.
Yeah. Let's have a look at state social welfare. You'll often see on the news people are outraged because food banks are helping more people than ever. I actually think that's a great thing. I think it's great if our voluntary charity sector is doing more than ever. I think that's the way that we should be helping people as much as possible. Obviously, I don't support eliminating the welfare state. I think there should be a safety net for our most vulnerable. But as much as possible, let's help them voluntarily. Do I personally contribute a hell of a lot in charity? I donate to a few small things, but the socialist definition of charity is probably my taxes, and I do pay a lot of those. But imagine how much I would be able to afford to help people voluntarily if I wasn't spending thousands and thousands on a public welfare system.
Now, let's say, for instance, you wanted to fund a project, I don't know, like the building of a school, for example, and you go out to the community and you go, right, who's a carpenter? Right, who owns a such and such wood manufacturer or whatever, who can provide building materials, who can provide labour, who can provide expertise, planning, and so on and so forth. And it gets to the point where you can actually make a school on the cheap and have the community actually be responsible for it.
Yep.
And as a result, when people build something themselves with their own hands, they tend to be protecting of that thing that they've just built.
That's right.
Whereas I find what's happening a lot of the times with the government in terms of what people are doing nowadays is they allow somebody else to come in, do it, bear no responsibility themselves, drop their kids off, and then that's it. And I've been saying on my radio show for a while now is that community is about as important to the human body as vitamin C is. You can't produce it on your own, and you need it every day.
Yep.
And at the moment, we're suffering a form of community scurvy. Partly because of the socialist policy of the way the city's being run, and indeed the way the world's being run to a large degree. I mean, look at America. Oh, it's a capitalist society. No, it's not. No, it gives bank a bailout. It's the worst form of communism I know.
Yeah. And you could take an example of the housing projects that they have in the US. Some of them end up getting knocked down because they're so vandalised, they're so poorly taken care of. The tenants in there bear no responsibility for it, they don't own it, and they trash it. And it's not the same as when you have private property or, you know, a community-based school where everyone's had a hand in building it. They've actually got a bit of self-interest in preserving it and making it run as well as possible.
Well, could we in some way instill that in Auckland, and precisely how would we actually go about that? How are we capable of rolling back the bureaucracy and the public spending and the borrowing and lowering the rates and everything like that at the same time as building a better community? Would it happen by osmosis, or does it actually need to be planned and facilitated properly?
You do initially need a cultural cultural change, you need people to recognise that the government can't do everything. It tries, it doesn't do a very good job. They need to recognise that perhaps they need to do some things for themselves. And until you have that cultural change, you're not going to see any change at the council. A way of identifying when that change has happened, I suppose, is when people like myself or people from Affordable Auckland eventually get elected. That might be a way of showing that that cultural change is occurring, but until then, it's not going to happen.
Now, the problem comes with, of course, getting yourself elected to a platform across a city of 1.4 million people, now? Including the fact that we have an enormous migrant population here as well, many of which don't even speak English, and also, on top of that, you have a voter turnout that's so low, it's almost insignificant.
40% last time in Auckland. Horrible.
well, it maybe the type of people that vote are the same people that have been voting the whole time in the first place, and I think they're the people who believe in the same policies that have got us into this very big problem area with their unitary plan, the massive budget blowouts, and the election of a corrupted mayor.
Yeah. Well, they're the people who are voting are probably the ones who think that the government can fix their problems, so they're trying to tell them how they want the problems fixed.
Well, see, and that's another thing. What's worse, somebody who votes and doesn't do anything for their community, or somebody who does heaps for their community and doesn't vote?
Oh, definitely the person who votes. It's interesting. You see, I know that they had some campaign in the States last presidential election to get everyone out to vote. I think it was called Rock the Vote or something trying to get young people to vote. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. If people are not interested in politics, don't encourage them to vote. Just get the people who really care about getting things done and have actually made the effort to inform themselves to vote.
Well, that's actually another problem as well, is the voting public is not informed. Even the ones that do vote are not informed. And it's very clear, considering the policies, regardless of whether you vote for the left or the right, don't seem to actually change all that much. And yet, incidentally, every time a new government is elected, they're elected platforming on change.
Well, I mean, we take the national government, all the things that Labor did and they opposed, such as working for families, zero interest on student loans, etc., they've kept. I am a national member. I joined a couple of months ago, but you know, the National Party's a broad church. So I don't agree with everything they do, but it is disappointing to see that every time Labor increases the size of the state, National does very little to roll that back.
My opinion is that there is very little difference between these two major parties, and what they've done is it's called full spectrum dominance. So you tell people who are of one persuasion one thing, and another people who are of another persuasion another thing, whereas both parties that are campaigning on those two very different platforms actually wind up accomplishing the same goal once elected. Much like Vladimir Lenin said, is don't worry, comrades, we're just telling the people what they want to hear, and once we get given the power, then we do what we want.
Well, I mean, they're fighting each other for the centre ground, because I suppose that's where all the votes are, but then they end up being exactly the same thing. And it's the case in just about every two-party system that you see across the world, United States, Britain. I mean, in the US, we see the Republicans. I mean, spending over there, I saw a great cartoon today. Elephant and the arse are in a big pool of water. There's water gushing out of the tap. The elephant says, we need to reduce it by 2 drops. The arse goes, no, that's draconian. We need to reduce it by 1 drop. So.
It doesn't make sense. Unless, of course, you take into account the internationalists and the money power elite, essentially, that are doing all the donations and what have you. I mean, I sent a message to the National Party website one time asking for a list of their donors. They're supposed to publicly publish a list of donors that do over $10,000. There wasn't one. Yeah, who's financing these parties?
Actually, that's interesting you bring that up. I put out a press release about a week or so ago about Len Brown. $270,000 he was donated. I think it's called the New Council Trust. And I put something out saying, well, you know, who are these people? They've donated about three quarters of your campaign funding. No idea who they are. And I would have thought a Labour Party member would be the first to put his hand up for transparency.
Well, I would disagree. That you know, it's more the fact that if you're funded by dirty money, it means you just take the money, more or less, you know, because otherwise you won't get elected. It's like they'll just go to the next guy. It's like, okay, well, you won't take our bribe, we'll just bribe your competition and you'll be left out in the cold.
And this donation's gone completely under the radar. The media's not interested in it. Maybe I need to bang away about it a bit more. But
well, can you go into it a bit more? Do you know any more details about it?
I don't know
it?
Too much details about it, but it is on his electoral return, which you can find on the Auckland Council website.
Mm-hmm.
New Council Trust, $270,000-something. That's all I know. I probably should make an Official Information Act request over it, because there's something suspect going on there.
Something, well, my little suspicion mode, as a conspiracy theorist, of course, goes up when you see something like that, and what occurs to me is the Committee for Auckland is the controllers of Auckland City, and because they're a private corporation that you have to pay something like $10,000 a year for membership.
Wow.
And you wind up having all of these massive banks, private contractors, and things of that nature, all part of this quote-unquote Committee for Auckland, who write the recommendations that the council winds up implementing. So, and incidentally, guess who gets awarded all the contracts?
Members of the committee.
All right. So you know, we've got a corporatocracy running the city, and I think that's actually the main point. So when you tell me that there's a huge donation coming in to Len Brown from a unknown organisation that requires an Official Information Act request in order to find out who the frack the buggers are, something tells me that the Committee for Auckland members are involved in that.
Yeah, well, surely it's not within the spirit of the I mean, I don't support the Electoral Finance Act, but surely it's not within the spirit of the law to have this $270,000 donation from a trust.
Well, what does this trust want? What do they want in return? I mean, it turns out in the United States, somebody did a study that it costs something like $30 million a year to bribe Congress and the Senate. For which they can get billions and billions of dollars in private contracts handed out to them, whether that be defence funding or public contracts or what have you. So if we've got a corporate takeover, this is the thing that I was thinking about privatisation yesterday, in fact, is that it swings from a spectrum. From one side, you have private companies that have, let's say, entrepreneurs at their heads, moral, ethical people want to serve the community. And on the other hand, you have private corporations, limited liability companies, who don't really have anybody at their head who really created it and founded it and is running everything and taking personal responsibility for what the company is doing. And they're much too large to really rein in terms of a government inquiry. It costs too much. And, you know, we don't want to threaten them because they might withdraw their bribes. And it turns into a corrupt mechanism. So I'm just wondering, I wonder at what size does a corporation become powerful enough to actually prevent itself from being accountable?
Well, the corporations and the bribery of Congress members is simply a symptom of the problem, though. The actual problem itself is that these government organisations have the power to dish out favours. Their functions are way beyond what was intended by the Founding Fathers when they wrote the US Constitution. The government's doing far more than it was ever meant to under that constitution, and so that leads to this future corruption. So we actually need to deal with the source of the problem, which is a government that does too much.
I think so, and it needs to be stepped back, and of course something has to step in to fill that void, and that's where voices in the community are supposed to come in. What's problematic, I found, is that they get ignored largely, you know. I mean, I see many community groups in South Auckland that are actually doing a really good job. They're they're reducing crime, they're reducing family violence, they're reducing homelessness through as simple things as being a finance company that doesn't charge recurring interest. You pay one fee on top of your loan, and then hey presto, you don't have any money worries. You don't beat your wife or your kids anymore. You know, it works like that. Yeah. And then of course the government comes in and tries to shut them down because you're just a bad person. And I was like,
you're exploiting the poor.
Yeah. It's really messed up. But it's only messed up to me because I'm not a sociopath. Yeah. I mean, if I was a psycho, for example, I'd look at the city and the way it's being run, and I'd be quite happy indeed to see what's happening to it. What kind of borrowing is Auckland City going under at the moment?
Well, we started off with a debt of $3.7 billion. That is now hitting the $7 billion mark. $1 billion was borrowed last year. $1.2 billion is being borrowed this year. There is no sign of it slowing down. There's no plan to stop borrowing. I'm getting pretty worried. We will be up to the $10 billion debt mark at the end of this council term if there's no change. And what? Then how do you reverse that and start paying it off?
Well, I think we should pull in Iceland and just go, look, your bank has made that money up, bro. There's nothing backing it. Just go home, all right?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't do that. I think if they've lent money, they do deserve to have it paid back.
Yeah.
But, I mean, our rates are high now, but with the borrowing levels we're doing, it's sentencing ratepayers of the future to guaranteed high rates. And how do we reverse that once you go too far? Something's got to be done about in the next 3 years. I mean, even by the next election, that's probably as late as we can do any real sort of change to it. Otherwise, you know, 10 years' time, we're in the shit.
Yeah, well, there's the deception value as well. For instance, the council says, we will not increase rates beyond the rate of inflation. And there's a clause in the council laws that allow them to make up their own rate of inflation.
I was not aware of that. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. And I mean, it has gone up over the rate of inflation every year. And Len Brown's been deliberately deceptive when he says an average 2.5% rate's increasing. That makes you sound like he's being fiscally responsible. But what we're finding is that the people in the old Auckland borough, which was actually run pretty fiscally responsibly, are facing 10% annual rate rises for the last 3 years, while people in Waitakere, which was a socialist basket case, are getting rates cuts. It seems so unfair that the people in the new super city are now getting penalised because their previous council was so responsible.
Seems like a similar policy to global warming taxes and what have you, doesn't it? Yeah. It's a transfer of wealth.
Yeah.
So are we going to see in Auckland in the future, if this process isn't stopped, a city in poverty, you know, Rio de Janeiro kind of thing? You know, we'll have to paint some of their houses bright colours so they don't look quite so bad.
My expectations at this stage are not optimistic, actually. and you also got to consider those, like, people in Iraqi, it is a pretty wealthy area, but a lot of those places are owned by pensioners on very limited incomes. A pensioner gets about, $400 a week, if they're lucky. How can they afford a rates rise? And those houses are worth, you know, over $1 million. Every rates rise is another step towards them being pushed out of their house and becoming dependent.
And foreclosed on, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, I was talking to a friend of mine, Evelyn Gilbert, who lives down in Raglan, and she lives in a beach community, and their rates have gone staggeringly up, and there's actually quite a lot of people who retired in, like, the 80s, the 90s, and they now have to move into a retirement home because they literally can't afford to keep their home because the rates are too high.
Yep.
I think that's freaking disgusting. It's despicable. How can you do that to people?
They're turning the rich into the poor.
Yeah. Well, I think they're just turning the middle class into the poor. And what I've noticed in speaking about how societies get run is the only way there's any kind of fairness or equity in a society is if if there's actually fairness in the equity, full stop. You know, if you have a lower class, a middle class, and an upper class, you have a middle class that has enough money to spend enough time on politics, studying stuff, be educated and whatnot, to hold the more powerful at bay and to help the poorer people up. Whereas if you only have the super poor and the super rich, you've got no equity whatsoever, no equality, no rights.
Though we also have to get away from the tendency of the left to focus on equality, because sometimes I think they'll be happy if everyone's equally poor.
Yeah, exactly. And here's the thing about pulling people up from their bootstraps. You don't pull them up from their bootstraps, they have to pull themselves up.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise you create dependency.
Exactly. I mean, if you have a prison, for instance, and you feed your inmates every day and you house them and everything like that, and you say, oh, we've got these guards here to keep you safe, you know, from the other prisoners, you're still living in a freaking prison, and it still costs like $26,000 a year or something of that nature just to put you through a quit smoking program.
Yeah. Shouldn't be that hard to quit smoking in a prison these days, I wouldn't think.
Apparently it's rather easy. I interviewed Dr. Green from the Dactory about this, and he goes, it was the best quit smoking program I ever participated in. Only cost the taxpayers $26,000 to make me stop smoking after all these years, you know? Yeah. And that's what happens, you know? It's like, if you have a spoiled brat who expects everything to be given to them and what have you find after a very short period of time that they keep asking for more and more until you realise one day that these people are more trouble than they're frickin' worth because they don't know how to take care of themselves.
Yep, very true.
That's what we're ending up with. We're ending up with an entire city, an entire society incapable of taking care of themselves. People don't know how to grow their food. I think also one thing would be really great is if people actually started collecting the rainwater off of their roofs to reduce the amount of dependency on water care services and all of that kind of stuff. If we could just gradually take this city down to a level where it's actually kind of fair, people have got enough money, they're not paying too much rates, they can actually afford to live where they're living, and they have accountable council that actually do what they say they're going to do, who actually get brought up on charges if they commit crimes, who actually stop companies being involved with the council if they're proven to be corrupt and or bribing councillors. At the moment, it's virtually the opposite to everything that I've said. Virtually the opposite to everything you and an affordable Auckland want.
Definitely.
How is the public receiving this, though? Because I'm aware of the situation, at least to an extent. It seems that the vast majority of the public are either part of the 40% who have no idea whatever, and they still vote anyway, or 60% who have no idea and don't care.
Well, I mean, we still have some very hardcore socialist rumps throughout the super city who tend to do most of the voting, I think. South Auckland's always been Labour territory. My experience is when I was in West Auckland and got booed off a couple of stages, also very similar. Then you've got areas in the North Shore, Rodney, Franklin, which voted the other way. But yeah, there's definitely still a wide-scale mindset of the council can do it for me, and therefore I'm not doing it for myself.
It reminds me of the Simpsons episode when Homer didn't want to take the trash out, and so he had this big massive pile of trash in his front yard, and the trash people wouldn't take it because he was really rude to them and what have you. So he runs for mayor of Springfield, and he winds up getting elected on a platform of, can't someone else do it?
I remember that. It was a great episode.
Yeah. And, how much for those suede shoes for the trash collectors? Yeah, that'll be good. And he blows the whole town's budget. And, just like nowadays, it's almost like we really have to shovel medical waste into the bloody town's mineshaft in order to keep the the coffers full of money. Yeah. You know, we're contaminating the whole frickin' city with this crap. Here's another thing. Speaking of contamination, what's your stance on roadside spraying with cancer-causing Roundup and whatnot?
It's not something I've looked into, actually, so I wouldn't want to make too much comment on it. It does kind of remind me of the booms issue, though. I mean, you would think being being on the right, that I would be anti the mowing of the berms, but I actually think it's council property, the council should do it. And so the council certainly should be maintaining those in an appropriate fashion, and I think getting rid of weeds is probably something they should be doing. I don't know all the intricacies of Roundup, so I couldn't comment on specifically what they're using, but I certainly think they should be maintaining those areas.
I agree so as well. It really shouldn't be the responsibilities of the residents to maintain council property for them, considering they're already paying their rapes. Freudian slip. And what I found really kind of disturbing about this is that looking into Roundup, I mean, first of all, it's made by Monsanto. There's your first warning sign, you know. Who made Agent Orange? Monsanto.
Yeah.
And didn't they say that was safe? Oh, yes, they did. Didn't they say Roundup was biodegradable? Oh, yes, they did. Doesn't it cause cancer, though, and is not biodegradable? Oh, yes, it is.
Oh, okay.
And what we've got now, I think, all of that stuff goes into the stormwater, winds up going into the sea and what have you. And my missus has been using a pine oil organic spray that is actually working far more powerfully than Roundup now, and doesn't contaminate the environment, doesn't have massive levels of glyphosate and all of these other chemicals and what have you in it. And it occurs to me that we've got so many issues of contamination within the city. You know, we've got, let's say, we've got fluoride in the water, for example, which is listed as a contaminant. It's a heavy toxin. And that goes down your drain, because we don't drink most of our water, do we? And the only way fluoride can actually be returned to the environment without causing environmental degradation is if it's filtered through human kidneys. So what we're doing is we're paying for an additive into the water supply that contaminates the water supply and the people drinking it and anything that they water their garden with and what have you.
I should probably state my position on fluoride before we continue.
Go for your life, son.
My personal position on it is I think it's safe and I have no issue with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, water's a publicly supplied good, so I would definitely be okay with having a referendum on the issue. I think seeing, you know, the entire public uses it, they should get a say on whether it's added or not. So I'm
What's your stance on forced medication?
Yeah, well, see, that's essentially what it is, so that's why I'd support a referendum on it.
Yeah, because I think that's basically what it comes down to. People have the right to refuse medication if they don't want it, and if you purposely put it into a water supply, you can't really escape from it. You shower in it, you drink it, you cook your food in it, that kind of thing. And it's actually almost prohibitively expensive to buy fluoride filters. You need I think it's a half micron thick filter sheet in order to get it out, which is the same thickness required to filter out uranium from water.
So that's why I support the referendum.
Yeah. But of course, that didn't work out too well for Hamilton. The people voted, or rather the councillors voted, to get the fluoride out of the water supply. And that was because we had doctors, dentists, and health professionals, MDs, and what have you, able to speak to the councillors.
Mm.
And because some of the councillors were on the district health board, who had public health policy stating that they have to support fluoride no matter what, they had to recuse themselves because it's a biased vote. Mm. And so as a result of those biased voters being voted out of the room, then 6 out of the 7 remaining councillors voted to get fluoride out.
Mm.
And then, Professor Paul Connett predicted, there would be a huge media defamation campaign against all those councillors in order to attack them and into reversing the policy and what have you. And then a public referendum was called out. The local district health board spent $48,000 on a public campaign to convince people that anybody who says that fluoride was bad for you was insane.
A disturbing use of public money.
I think so. But that's the only reason I believe that fluoride is even in our water at the moment, is because people are using public monies to brainwash the public into accepting it without looking at any of the facts, as these councillors did. I mean, if you elected somebody and you trust trusted them enough to actually give them your vote and elect them, and they put through a policy, for example, like removing fluoride from the water, regardless of your belief, shouldn't you? I don't know really where I'm getting at here. It's just more the fact that I really don't want to be force medicated, and it really F's me off when people get their own taxpayer money put into a coffer to convince them of something that has no actual scientific evidence behind it.
Well, whatever your thoughts on fluoride, I don't think public money should be spent on promoting it or dissing it in any way.
Now, let's take it back to individual responsibility. If you wanted fluoride, there are sacks of fluoride with skull and crossbones that are in perfect powder that have cadmium and iron and all sorts of other wonderful good chemicals for you and what have you that they get out of the phosphate fertilizer industry in China that we fluoridate our water with. So if you want fluoridated water, just buy one of these level 6 biotoxin sacks of fluoride and wear a hazmat suit when you put a teaspoon of it into your water when you drink it every day. It should be fine, you know. You can take personal responsibility for your own contamination rather than making it forced on everybody else. And I think that's really what it comes down to. It's forcing a choice, and I don't like to have any choices forced upon me. You know what I'm saying?
I guess that's always the moral hazard of public goods, isn't it?
Well, and again, if we have a look at public goods, I've seen almost the. The opposite is true in every single case. This is going to be really good for you because such and such, and it turns out later on upon study there's actually really bad for you because of such and such a reason. Like you take the medical industry, for example. My brother's a chiropractor and he's working in Tahiti now. And I think 2 weeks ago when I was having my wedding, he was over here and we had a look at, or at least he was telling me about a new study that came out of the United States studying the deaths caused by accidents in the American medical system. It used to be previously thought that every 60 seconds there would be one person. So it winds up being about maybe 25, 26,000 people a year. But it turns out it's actually 7 people every minute and winds up going, or something like that, and about maybe 400,000 a year.
Wow.
Which is the leading killer in the United States. And that's just accidents. That doesn't include people who die because they've been given chemo or die because of medications that weren't good for them and so on and so forth. Just accidents. If you add on the other things, it's so much the number one killer. The public health sector in America is its number one killer. And even the Ministry of Health in New Zealand publishes similar statistics in 2006. They said just accidents caused in New Zealand by biomedical things, you know, like they'll sew somebody up with accidentally a pair of scissors still inside them or something like that, and they'll die from that. Third leading cause of death in New Zealand doesn't include vaccine reactions or anything like that. And so my thought is, if it comes from an official source, assume for a moment that it's the exact opposite of whatever they're stating it is.
Well, we have to keep in mind that every medication that's been recalled by the Food and Drug Administration was first approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
And incidentally, the pharmaceutical companies who were producing that medication incidentally have people that they donate to that are on the boards of the FDA and used to work for them as their CEO or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
In some cases, with up to 14 financial connections to the pharmaceutical industry is what I've seen published in some manuals. And it's quite, you just have to look. As soon as you look, that's when you start seeing the problems. And I think that people don't see the problem with fluoride public health policy or local council and accountability in government and the overcosting and the overzealous nature of roading and what have you, because they just haven't looked. And I think it's because shows like mine aren't very well received because the truth is offensive. Really? I mean, wouldn't you agree that's kind of half the reason why you might have gotten booed off stage, because you were telling the truth and people just get offended by it?
Yes, well, I can tell you, telling people that if they want to preserve heritage they should do it themselves is not very popular out in Waitakere. And they definitely love their liquor licensing trusts out there. Someone asked a question, what were we going to do about them? And I got straight up and said, I'll abolish them straight away.
Yeah.
Yeah. don't do that in Waitakere.
Yeah. What's your problem with the Liquor Licensing Trust?
It's a coercive monopoly. I don't think they should have that power to control alcohol sales. I think alcohol sales should be up to... leave it up to the market. Let people build their liquor store and, you know, they succeed or fail on their own. It's interesting, anti-alcohol campaigners will like to try and limit the number of liquor stores. It doesn't actually reduce liquor-related harm. It just entrenches the profits of the existing stores. Their competition's being wiped out by all these anti-liquor crusaders. Whereas if you had a high concentration of liquor stores in a particular area, it's not going to grow the amount of money being spent on alcohol. They're just going to eat into each other's profit margins. And, you know, some of them will end up closing because they'll be unsustainable. So all this interference is actually just making the existing owners richer.
Now, is it making the alcohol problem worse or better, I wonder? I mean, statistically speaking, you know, how many incidents of arrests for drunk and disorderly behaviour has West Auckland been reduced since establishing the Portage Licensing Trust for the sale of liquor in West Auckland, or has it gone through the roof?
I haven't had a look at those figures, so it'd be unfair for me to comment, but I recall putting up election signs about midnight last year, and there is a heavy police presence around the town areas, for example, Henderson, etc., so I wonder if it's really having an impact.
What concerns me is also, I think, local government getting involved in people's drug consumption. You know, alcohol's a drug. We all know it is. It's a very dangerous drug too, and certain people just can't handle it, and they go out of control. They get violent and obnoxious, and it's really annoying. I think Bill Hicks said you can tell a lot about society by the drugs that it uses, and our society uses coffee 5 days a week to keep you awake so that you can work at your slave job and work efficiently, and then alcohol during the weekend so you can forget that you're a slave for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't support the new laws that have come in over liquor. I think it's an issue of individual responsibility. It's an issue of cultural change. Laws aren't going to change the fact that people like to binge and get wasted.
Yeah,
they're just going to do it within a smaller time frame. The council does have the power to set local alcohol policies that are around, you know, the 4 o'clock closing time we have now. I advocate opening it back up to the 24-hour licences. I don't think because of a few people's irresponsibility, everyone else should be penalised. People should be free to enjoy it responsibly without those restrictions, I think.
I think so too, because I had my stag night a couple of weeks ago, bro, and at 11:06 we were like, all right, let's go get us a box of beer and then we'll go have a drink somewhere, it'll be fun, rather than paying $10 per beer at a bar. Turns out, through the liquor licensing everywhere, all the supermarkets stopped selling their beer at 11 o'clock.
Yes.
Damn it! It was the worst stag night ever.
And interestingly, it means that instead of you getting pissed at home, maybe you'll have too much, maybe it won't be a good experience, but at least you're having it at home instead of going out to town and then causing trouble.
Yeah. And it just kind of got to the point where I was like, I'm really, really sick of having my choices restricted by somebody else. I mean, if I'm not hurting anybody, and if I'm not damaging anybody's property, and if I'm taking personal responsibility for my behaviour, nobody should be able to tell me what I can and can't do.
Yep.
Right?
And I get really grumpy. Your local suburban newspaper, every couple of weeks you'll see a group of neighbours are all standing like this in front of their house or in front of a liquor store. Community says no to the liquor store. I don't think they should have that right.
Yeah.
And, you know, they could say no, they cannot patronise it, but I don't think they should be able to use the law to stop that liquor store being in place. What I do like is an experiment that they're doing in the UK with private holding tanks for people. If they get too drunk, the police throw them into the holding private tank until they sober up, and then the company charges them for their care. I think that's a good way to instill some sort of responsibility.
Well, I remember when I was in high school in Waiheke, and we had a Spanish exchange student, and we were 18. It was seventh form year. And we're always going out and getting drinking on the weekends, you know, as you do in high school when you're able to buy liquor. And what I found was the Spanish guy never got too pissed. And we were curious about this. We asked him, you know, why is this? Why have you got kind of, you know, you're drinking under control. It doesn't really matter what you're drinking, whether it's wine or spirits or beer. You kind of tend to be able to control yourself. Mm. And he says, well, in Basque country, man, we just drink wine from the age of like 6 or 7 or whatever, you know, one with dinner, and it becomes part of the culture. It's an everyday thing. Nobody goes out of control. And once you've got a drinking culture that isn't self-destructive, and it's actually there with a almost a responsible to not drink too much, because you drink all the time anyway and you don't really need to, that's when the culture changes. And we have seen a dramatic decrease in the amount of alcohol-related violence and injuries and car accidents and what have you as a result of these really quite massive campaigns against drink driving and drunk violence and these things like that you see on the television ads all the time. You know, like,
and that's creating a cultural change. It's not through extra regulation.
Yeah, but however, it is using taxpayer money in order to finance the advertising rather than allowing the culture to develop on its own.
Yeah.
Which occurs to me is that people's culture is determined by what they see on TV.
I think that probably is.
Alright, which means that the community's just not there anymore. Okay, it's all very well talking about community spirit, but there ain't a community at all. To a large degree, people are all at home watching TV, don't know their neighbours.
Yeah.
All right. And I think I actually include myself in that. I mean, I don't watch TV anymore because I didn't bother getting a Freeview box or what have you. But I don't know my neighbours, and I don't think most people do. And it's pretty difficult to give a frack about your community if you don't even know that one exists.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a cultural change we can work on. My very special guest from Affordable Auckland is Stephen Berry, joining me for 3 hours. And we will be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, after we take a WikiLeak. We'll be right back.